want to go ahead and get into my reading lesson. It's somewhat lengthy. I apologize up front, but I want to get everything in here. I'm not going to be able to go verse by verse through this, but I want we're going to get as much of it as we can. But I want to read in Colossians, the book of Colossians. One of those small letters that Paul wrote there in the New Testament. And we're going to read the third chapter of Colossians. I'm going to read the whole third chapter to get our setting here this morning. So Colossians, third chapter, starting in the first verse. If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with him in glory. Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetous, which is idolatry, for which things sake the wrath of God cometh on the children of disobedience, in which ye also walked some time when ye lived in them. But now ye also put off all these things: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communications out of your mouth. Lie not to one another, seeing that ye have put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. Where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised nor circumcision nor uncircumcision, barbarian, Scythian, bond or free, but Christ is all in all. Put on, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercy, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, and long-suffering, forbearing one another, and forgiving one another, if any man have a quarrel against any. Even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye. And above all things, put on charity, which is the bond of perfectness. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to the which also ye are called in one body, and be ye thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. And whatsoever ye do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by him. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands, as it is fit in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives, and be not bitter against them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God. And whatsoever ye do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men, knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for ye serve the Lord Christ. But he that doeth wrong shall receive for the wrong which he hath done, and there is no respect of persons. We'll go ahead and end our reading there. Now, I want to give just a little bit of background of what's going on. Paul has a theme here in the book of Colossians, and we've kind of picked up on just one part of that, but I want to give you an understanding of what has been going on. But like all of the churches that Paul is dealing with and writes letters to, there's different issues that come up. And sometimes there's common threads that run through a lot of the different issues, but certain churches, because of their geographic locations and the prevailing culture around them, certain issues you find in certain places that you might not find in others. And so what's going on in Colossae, in the churches there, is there are errors creeping in amongst the congregation. And just like all of the other churches where he writes, where he finds errors in Galatians and in Corinthians and Romans, those errors come from the outside. See, because we, the church there, just like our churches today, are influenced by the prevailing culture. Whether we want to be or not, we are. We're influenced by the prevailing prevailing culture. And that's not always bad or good. Sometimes it's neutral. I would say our form of worship, we come and we sit down and we have a song and we have a prayer and we maybe have another song and, we have preaching. And all the form of how we is very much due to our prevailing culture. And it's come down through us, to us through the years because of prevailing culture in the West, and it's the way we do things. If you go to churches in Africa, they don't quite do things the way that we do. Now, they sing songs that glorify God, and they have sound preaching, but the way they conduct their service is a little bit different. It's been influenced by the prevailing culture. So that doesn't necessarily, being influenced by the culture is not necessarily bad or good, but it can be one or the other. And so there are some ideas creeping into the church at Colossae, and specifically three of them that are intertwining that I want to just mention. From the prevailing Greek culture, there is a philosophy of Gnosticism, which is prevailing. Now, the Gnostics, there was two defining characteristics of Gnosticism. Number one, they denied the divinity of Jesus Christ. Number two, they put a very high value on secret and mystical wisdom. And so the Gnostics were always seeking some higher level of knowledge, some inside secret, some teaching, some new or higher level of teaching. And so that was a Greek philosophy that had worked its way into the church. You also had because of where Colossae was situated, you had influence from Persian philosophy and Persian religions. And the influence from Persia was, the best I could describe it, is this idea of anti-materialism. And basically, it was this dualistic philosophy of the material world and the spiritual world. And those two things were completely separate. And everything that's spiritual is good, and everything that's material is bad. That was the philosophy that came from Persia, and it worked its way through some of Greek thinking, and it was prevalent in that area. And what that led to was heresy on two ends. They could go to either extreme. The idea that everything that's spiritual is good and everything that is material is bad could lead to asceticism, just going off into a cave and denying all, pleasure, everything, just kind of living as an ascetic on the one end. And on the other, it could materialize all the way to, the flesh is just flesh and it's all going to burn anyway, and the spirit is good and it can't be affected. And so sin doesn't really matter because it's only the flesh that's sinning and not the spirit. And then that would lead to just basically living however you want because it's only my flesh that's sinning. It's not my spirit. And they're separate. You see how it could go both ways. But that idea was working itself in. And finally, you had a Jewish influence, and there was lots of different Jewish sects that were with different philosophies, but one that was prevalent in this area was the Essenes. And the Jewish Essenes were known for asceticism and ritualism. And so that was working its way. So all of these philosophies were intertwining and beginning to show up in some things that were happening in Colossae. And so Paul is addressing those. And so in the first chapter, I'm not going to go back there and read, but in the first chapter, he focuses on establishing the divinity of Christ. So he's attacking that Gnostic idea that Christ was not divine. He attacks that head on, and he establishes in the first chapter the divinity of Christ. And then in the second chapter, he goes on and establishes that we can know Christ. Again, an attack against Gnosticism, this idea that there's some things that are unknowable and we're trying to learn more. So he said we can know Christ. And then in the second part of chapter 2, he begins to attack this idea of asceticism, and it was working its way in. He talks there in the second chapter, he said, touch not, taste not, handle not. Those people that are judging you and saying that you need to observe certain feast days and certain this and certain that. That was that Jewish element that was working its way in. This idea that you had to observe all these forms and rituals. And you had to be very particular not to touch this or taste this or do that or do this. And he said, basically he sums it all up and says, that's fine for the body, but it doesn't do anything for the spirit. It's not going to get you anywhere. And so as he addresses those things, then he comes to chapter 3. Now, what I want us to understand is these were vain philosophies of the world that Paul was attacking, but they had worked their way into the church. And we today are no different. We have vain philosophies of the world that are working their way into the church. Even if we don't invite them in, they come in. When we walk out those doors, when we're in the workplace, when we turn on the TV, when we open a book or a magazine, all of the world around us is full of vain philosophies. I just got you up to speed on some of the vain philosophies in Paul's day, but you see, there's nothing new under the sun. You can probably, if you're thinking about it, you can see a common thread with those things and the vain philosophies of today. They haven't changed much. They go under different names and there's slightly different nuances, but we've got the people that say, you need to deny yourself everything. Now, those are a dying breed these days, but we've definitely got the people that say, just sin all you want, and we've got those that love rituals. Oh, man loves ritual, doesn't he? God gave a beautiful religion to the Jews there at Mount Sinai, and they turned it into nothing but form and religion. And very quickly, in 300 years or so after Jesus Christ established his church, and the first generation church went out, and we read all the things that happened in the book of Acts, and it wasn't but about 300 years, and Christians got together, and they began to form a ritual, and we have the Catholic Church and the Orthodox traditions today in Christianity that are very heavy on ritual. And then, of course, you've got those in the world that deny the divinity of Christ. And so all of these vain philosophies that were infecting the church in Colossae infect us today. And so we need to be aware. Now, why does this matter? Because what happened in Colossae is the same thing that will happen to us. And that is, these vain philosophies were portraying a false view of what righteousness was. This is important. Those that were teaching asceticism and saying, well, to be righteous before God, you've got to observe all these different ritual things. You've got to abstain from this and observe these feast days and all these different things. Some were saying that. The Gnostics were saying, oh, well, true righteousness is the pursuit of knowledge, of the secret mysteries. And we've got a lot of Christianity today that spends a whole lot of time trying to find something new and novel in the Scriptures, don't they? Trying to find some new thing. And they said, well, that's righteousness. The more you can know about the Bible and try to come up with all of these newfangled ideas, that there's some righteousness in that. And so all of these vain philosophies that we're working in, what it does is begins to give Christians in the church a wrong view of what righteousness really is. What are the things that you should be pursuing? And when we get a wrong view of righteousness, we begin to get a wrong view of salvation. And that then leads to wrong teaching on how to even find God. And ultimately, it leads to, for children of God, it leads to wrong views of Christian living. And that's really what Paul was addressing here. And that's what I want to focus on today is practical Christianity. That's my thought today is practical Christianity. Because all of this error that was creeping into the church, what Paul saw was it was leading people to not living out their Christianity the right way. They were pursuing the wrong things. and not pursuing the correct things. And so, but to fix that, he had to go back and he had to start laying some new groundwork, and he had to meet these different philosophies head on. I can't do all that, every competing philosophy in the world, I can't do that here this morning, but hopefully you see some parallels in the things that we've already talked about. But when once he addresses some of those things, he comes into the third chapter and he says, now this is what you need to hold on to. This is practical Christianity. This is what it means to live as a Christian. And isn't that what we really want to know? Once we've been saved and we're trying to follow God, don't we want to know, what is it that I should do on a day-to-day basis? How should I live? And that's what Paul is trying to set before them, because all of these vain philosophies out there had gotten everything twisted up and people were pursuing all kinds of different things in an effort to live the Christian life, but they were going the wrong way. And so Paul tries to get them back on track here. And so the principles of Christian living. And like I said, I can't go verse by verse. We don't have time. But I'm going to try to dig into as much of this as we can this morning. First of all, he starts off with the very first verse. If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above. So Paul puts number one where number one needs to be. You need to be risen with Christ. Part of the problem that is going on in the Christian world is there's a whole lot of quote unquote Christian leaders, and there's a whole lot of books. Well, if you want to know about Christian living, just go out to the Christian bookstore and pick you up a book on the shelf. There's all kinds of books out there to tell you about Christian living. The problem is, how many of those authors know Jesus Christ? I don't know. I'm not disparaging any of them in particular, but I'll tell you what, when I pick up a book, whether it's a book about practical Christianity, whether it's a commentary, anything to do with the Bible, the first thing I want to assess is I want to try to get an idea, does this person that's writing, do they know God? Sometimes that's harder to get a handle on than you might think. It's hard to make a determination. I've read pages and pages written by people. They're talking about the Bible, talking about God. And I get to the end, I'm like, I'm not even sure if they really know God. They didn't really say anything there that gave me a warm, fuzzy feeling that they've had a heartfelt conversion, that they've ever met Jesus Christ. Now, that doesn't mean that they haven't. But I'm just telling you, that's the first thing. Because if they don't know the Lord, then what is it they're writing about? What is it they're trying to teach about? And so, the number one thing, if you want to live a Christian life, you need to get to know the Lord. You need to be saved first. You have to be risen with Christ. And so there's no Christian living outside of salvation. That's the very first thing. And that's where Paul starts off with. He said, now, if you're risen with Christ, if you're truly saved, the first thing you need to do is to seek those things that are above. And so then he begins to break this down, and I tried to put this in a formula that makes sense to me, the way that he has put it. But we're going to start off with the first thing that you've got to do is put off the old man. You have to put off the old man. And he uses that expression down there in the 8th verse. But now, put off all these things. In the 9th verse, he says, put off the old man with his deeds. So, the first thing you do is you have to put off. Now, that phrase, put off, has reference to taking off a garment. To take off a garment. And so, the picture that Paul is putting into the minds here is you need to take off a garment first. You need to take off the garment of the old man. The garment of the sinful man. The garment of that man or woman that was an enemy of God that you wore before you were saved. And he says that. For which things sake the wrath of God. In 7th verse, in the which also ye walked sometimes when ye lived in them. When you were lost out there in the world, every one of us, when we were lost, whether you were lost for 5 minutes or 5 years or 50 years, you were wearing the garment of a lost man. And this is what it looked like. He said, you need to take that off first. So first off, take off the things of the old man. And he puts these in two categories. I want to categorize these into two things. Character and action. So first, you need to take off the character of the old man. He says, and he starts right off, the very first thing, fornication. Fornication. Now, I'm putting it first because Paul put it first. Why is it important? Well, I've told you before prevalent that was in heathen Greek society. They didn't view fornication or sexual impurity in any kind. They just did whatever they wanted. People got saved that had come up in that tradition, and they didn't know that you just can't live like that. So he had to teach on that. Now, 100 years ago, maybe in Christian churches, we didn't need to teach on that too hard. But we live in a time that is becoming increasingly heathen and pagan when it comes to sexual purity, haven't we? And who's going to teach our children that if we don't teach it? And we need to understand, Paul put it first because it was so important. There is no way to draw close to God as long as we are still being driven by our impure sexual appetites. And we live in a world that's just got those everywhere, don't they? I wish we had more young people because they need to learn that. We need to understand that outside of this church, nobody, nowhere in the world are they going to tell children, hey, the first thing you've got to do is learn to control that. You have to control those things and put them into the proper box where God has put them. And that is in the context of a marriage between one man and one woman. Everything else is outside of that, and you're not going to be able to have a close walk with God. You're not going to be able to grow in your relationship with God if you are still practicing that kind of sexual immorality. And again, the world is throwing that at us everywhere that we go. And it's, and I say young people, but listen, it's not just young people. None of us are to the point that we are not that we are past this. That's why it's so important. It's foundational. It's foundational to be able to control that through walking with God. But the understanding of the necessity of it. There's so much of the Christian world, I'm afraid, and so much of the missionary Baptist world that just kind of put that on a back burner and say, well, yeah, it's a sin, but you know, it's a sin, but. Listen, no, Paul never said it's a sin, but. He said first, he put it in the front. And he said the first thing, when he's listing, this is how you need to live practically. The first thing he says is get rid of fornication. You say, well, that's an action. I put it under character because it's a frame of mind. It's a frame of mind of seeking out those kinds of pleasures of the flesh to the exclusion of what is good to the spirit. And again, that word fornication in the Greek is porneia, and it's conjugated lots of different ways, but you all can see that it's the root word of where we get our word in English, pornography. And so what Paul is talking about when he uses the term fornication, he's talking about every sexual sin outside of marriage, and that includes the rampant use of pornography in our society today. That falls into that category. You can't grow in the Christian graces until that is got under control. It's a character issue. He puts it first. I'm going to move on. He says uncleanness. Uncleanness is immoral living. Now, that's not just sexual immorality, but that's drunkenness, gluttony, rioting. That's living in a manner that is immoral, whatever that way is. And again, we live in an immoral world, don't we? He said you've got to put, that's a character flaw. If you continue to live in those immoral fashions, chasing the lust of the eye and the lust of the flesh and the pride of life, if you continue after that, that's the old man. He said you've got to put that off. You've got to put that off. Immoral uncleanness or immoral living. Inordinate affection. Inordinate affection. What that means is evil passions. Evil passions. But what it really means, you break it down even more, it's any intense desire that is over and above the desire for God. Oh, now that starts to hit it home a little bit. You say, well, I don't have any evil desires, evil passions. What about all the things that when we're all guilty of putting things before God, whether it's a sports or a hobby or our job or whatever it might be, things I want you to think about, things that you're passionate about, that you spend time researching and learning about, and whether it's a neutral thing or not, is your passion for that thing greater than your passion for God? That's what he's talking about. Now that starts to hit home a little bit for all of us, doesn't it? I know it does for me. I know it does for me. Am I as passionate or more passionate about God than I am about certain other things in my life? I'm sad to say sometimes I miss the mark on that. But he says that's part of putting off the old man. Inordinate affections. If you have great desire and affection for something, whatever it is in this life, that exceeds your passion and affection for God, then it's inordinate affection. And it needs to be put off. Again, we're talking about character. These are inside things. Other people can't see that, right? That's what I mean about character. There are things that are on the inside other people can't see. That's between you and God. See, that's what you got to get straightened out first, is the character issues. He said, put off fornication, put off uncleanness or immoral living, put off inordinate affections. Evil concupiscence. We don't use that word concupiscence much anymore. But what it means is desire for the forbidden. The desire for the forbidden. Now we know that's a human trait, isn't it? We want the thing that we're not supposed to have. Now that's natural. But you remember how Jesus, when he said, you have heard of old time that it's a sin to commit adultery. But I say, if you've lusted after a woman in your heart, you've committed adultery. He's talking about evil concupiscence. He's not talking about a fleeting thought. Listen, a bird lands. I heard an old Christian say one time, talking about in this vein of things, he said, you can't help if a bird lands on your head. You can't help if a thought pops into your head. We're human. We got this flesh. He said, but you don't have to let that bird make a nest there. And so that's evil concupiscence. When we let those evil thoughts make a nest there, and we begin thinking about it and pondering about it, say, oh, well, I would never act on this sin, but I let it roll around in my head. I ponder on it. I think about it. How many of us are guilty of those things? That's what Jesus was talking about when he said, if you've lusted after a woman. He said, you've heard it said of old time, thou shalt not kill. I say, if you hate your brother, you don't have to kill him, but if you've had to let those evil thoughts of what you'd like to do to him roll around in your head, oh, I wish I could kill him. I wish he was dead. You let that roll around in your head, that is evil concupiscence. It's character. It's character. It's got to be flushed out. Finally, in the character category, he sums it up with covetousness. He says, covetousness, which is idolatry. Now, we know that one of the chief sin is idolatry. It's the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. That's idolatry. How is covetousness idolatry? Well, I heard a brother many years ago preach a wonderful sermon on covetousness and how it is idolatry. And the long and the short of it is, when you covet something, what is coveting? It's wanting what you don't have that somebody else has, isn't it? Well, don't you have the things that God has given you? When we covet, we say, I'm not content with what I have. I want something else. I am not content, God, with what you've given me. I'm not content, God, with you. That's the root of covetousness, is not being content with God. And is not that the root of idolatry? If you look back to those ancient Israelites, when they were got involved with idolatry, isn't that, we're not content with the provisions of Jehovah. We'd like to have some of the provisions that Molech has given to his people. Some of the provisions that Baal. We still want to worship Jehovah, but we want to worship Baal and Molech too, because we're not content with Jehovah. We want to add some more to it. That's covetousness. That's covetousness. When we covet, that's why it's idolatry, because it's not being content with God and what He has given us. Again, that's character. Paul says, put off those character issues. Put that off. And then, once we put off those character things, then we can get on to some of the actions. He says, this is down in the 8th verse now, malice. Malice, we know what that is. Ill will, the desire to injure. We've got to put off malice towards other people. Injurious behavior, injurious language, lashing out to hurt. Not always with our fists, but with our tongue sometimes. That's malicious behavior. He said, you've got to put that off. Blasphemy. Many times we think of blasphemy in relation to blaspheming against God, but what it really means is evil language. Blasphemy is evil speaking. Speaking bad about other people. Well, that's a hard one, isn't it? I'll admit I have been guilty of this when it comes to many of our leaders over the years. I've spoke evil things about them, and that's not right. That's not right. That doesn't mean you have to agree with everything, but you see, the Christian response is not evil speaking. That's blasphemy. He says, put that off. Don't speak evil about people. You got to be more like David was. He didn't speak evil about Saul, did he? Even though Saul was seeking after his life. He said, let God judge between me and thee. When Saul died, David mourned. When that Amalekite came and thought he would get gain from David by saying, I killed your enemy Saul, David had him killed. He said, how dare you raise your hand to God's anointed? See, he still had respect for Saul, even though Saul had been an enemy to David. He didn't speak evil of him. He didn't think evil of him. Vile conversation. Vile conversation. Boy, we live in a world that has become more and more vile, don't we? I mean, I'm not just talking about filthy language. I'm talking about filthy topics of conversation. When I was a kid, I don't remember, you know, I heard bad language on the television from time to time, but I don't remember ever really as a kid just standing around in the grocery store in line and hearing adults, you know, out in public, use foul language. I really don't. Maybe I was sheltered in West Virginia where I grew up, but I'm telling you, 30, 40 years ago, I don't remember that as a kid. Now you can't go anywhere without hearing foul language all around you. Matter of fact, I remember this one time. This was in Australia when I was there in 1992. In the church where my dad pastored was in kind of a little rough area, and there was some stuff. And was walking with one of the deacons of the church. Now he was a saved man that had lived a pretty rough life before that. Was a football player. He was played rugby. He was a pretty big guy. And we were walking. I was walking with him, and his son was my friend, and his wife was in a wheelchair. She had MS, and I remember these guys, maybe in their 20s, walking by, and they were like over here, and they were dropping some foul language. And I remember him spoke. He said, "Hey, what are you doing? I'd appreciate you not speaking like that in front of my wife." And they were like, "Oh yes, sir. Sorry about that." Well, you don't hear much of that anymore. Somebody that's bold enough to tell somebody, "Hey, don't speak like that," and then other people that are ashamed enough say, "No, you're right. I shouldn't." See, we live in a vile society. Not just the words that are used, but the topics of conversation. I mean, how vile and wicked. What we used to call locker room talk, that's not fit for the locker room either, but I hear it everywhere, all the time, in mixed company. You do too. And it bleeds itself into us. See, if we're not careful, we'll get caught up into that type of vile conversation. That's not fitting for a Christian. That's not fitting for a child of God to use that kind of language, be in those kinds of conversations. I had to walk away from a lot of conversations when I was in the Marine Corps. Now, I was fortunate enough as the officer, as the boss, and when my men got to know me enough, they had enough respect. Usually, 9 times out of 10, they didn't get into vile conversation. Now, they used profane language, but that didn't bother me so much. But they avoided vile topics of conversation because they knew I didn't like it, and I would just, you know, dismiss myself. Now I had that advantage because I was the boss, and maybe they gave me more respect than they would give, you know, to their peers. But it's difficult. But we have to teach our kids that. We have to teach our kids that. We have to be willing to do that. We have to understand we can't be involved and around those types of vile conversations. And finally, he says, lie not. Lie not. You know, when over there in Proverbs, these six things the Lord hates, yea, seven are abomination. Two of those seven are about lying. He says a lying tongue and somebody that speaks lies against the brethren, doesn't he? God does not like a lying tongue, but we get involved in it, don't we? We get involved in it. I mean, I've from time to time been taught, all of a sudden a lie pops out of my mouth, and I'm like, how did that even come out? Why did I even say that? Maybe you have too. See, we start to avoid that if we start to, you know, these things are not easy to do, but Paul says that we can. We have to identify these things and put them off. Again, you say, well, this all sounds pretty basic. Yeah, it is basic, but we need to get it right. This is Christian living. Not some esoteric knowledge that we don't have. Not some crazy asceticism. Not some ritual. Taste this, don't taste that, do this, don't do that. This is practical living. This is what Paul says. He says, put off all of those things. But then he says, but now put on. Notice, put on. He said, take off. So don't just take off. He said, well, this is all negative. Get rid of this, get rid of that, get rid of this other thing. For everything that he says to get rid of, all of those character flaws and all of those actions that he says, put those off, he says, and rather put on. Take off that old garment, but put this new one on. He's not leaving us in a vacuum here. He says, exchange the old things for these new things. Put off these character traits, put off these actions, and put on these new ones. He says, 12th verse, put on therefore, as the elect of God, bowels of mercy. Now, I had to study that phrase, bowels of mercy, a little bit. It's basically the idea is mercy that comes from the deepest part of us, from our bowels, if you will. Mercy that is deeply felt, not surface level. The best way I could come up with explaining it is exceeding compassion. Empathy, we might say. Let that define our character, being exceedingly compassionate. Now, I tell you right away, that is a character flaw of mine. I'm not an overly compassionate person. It's not in my nature. It never has been. But it's something I know that I need to work on. It's not that I'm, you know, dispassionate. It's just I don't have that kind of deep feelings of compassion. Don't come as natural to me as they do to some people. But it's something that as Christians we need to put on. Paul says that's the first thing, is a deep empathetic compassion for other people. He says, put that on. Get rid of your fornication and your uncleanness and put on bowels of mercy. Put on kindness. And kindness here means gentleness. Having a gentle nature about you. We could all be more gentle, couldn't we? Gentle with one another. Gentle with other people. Having a gentle character. That doesn't mean Jesus had a gentle character, but he still chased the money changers out when the time came. He still spoke harsh words when they were necessary. And he was very sharp with those Pharisees, but boy, wasn't he gentle? Wasn't he gentle with truly humble sinners? Always he was gentle with truly humble sinners. That's what it's talking about, is being gentle. Kindness. Put on humbleness of mind. That's true humility. If you read in the bulletin, pastor's comments, I wrote a little bit about humility in there. And how that, and I owe a lot of those thoughts that I got there from to Charles Spurgeon about humility. But that's what God truly desires in us. And the thought that I ran across and that is that God desires to bless us to the greatest degree possible. Do you agree with that? Don't you agree that the Scripture teach that? That God knows how to bless His children? He wants to bless us in the greatest way that we can handle. And therefore, if we don't have the blessings that we might think we want, why has God withheld them? Not because he doesn't want to give them to us, but because he knows they're not good for us. They're not good for us. That's why the Scripture says, not many wise, not many noble are calling. Why? Because not many wise and not many noble are humble enough to be called. Not many are raised up to great riches and fame among Christian ranks. Why? Because that kind of blessing would really be a curse for most of us. Most of us would be lifted up in pride if we had the kind of a blessing of great wealth and great notoriety. Some can handle it, but most probably couldn't. And so God doesn't bless us with those things because in the end it would be a curse, because we just couldn't handle it. It would lift us up in pride and it would ultimately be our downfall. But what God wants, and to that end, Paul says, put on humbleness of mind. Seek after great humility as a character trait. Meekness. Meekness means patient calmness. Jesus said, "The meek shall inherit the earth." Now, I want to distinguish, meekness does not mean weakness. There's a difference. There's a difference. There's no nobility. There's no great character in just being weak. Just being weak doesn't prove anything. Jesus wasn't weak. He let them know that. Why? When they came to get him in the Garden of Gethsemane, he put out his arm, and 500 or so, all the guard that came, they fell down. He was demonstrating his power. He said, "Don't you know that I can even yet call 12 legions of angels?" He said, "I have power. I'm not weak, but I am meek because I choose not to use the power. I am submitting." That is meekness. It's not weakness, but it's meekness. It's being gentle, patient calmness. That's what Jesus had. That's what we should have. And finally, character that we need to put on is long-suffering. That's pretty self-explanatory. Able to suffer long. Able to suffer things in this life. Able to suffer persecution. Able to suffer people speaking ill of us. Able to suffer people not understanding what we're trying to do or why we're trying to do it. Being able to suffer those that are unfairly against us. Whatever it might be. Long suffering. Aren't you glad God's long suffering? Paul says, put that on as a character trait. So, as far as character, take off, put off fornication, uncleanness, uncleanliness, inordinate affections, evil concupiscence, and covetous. That's the character of the old man. Put that off, but put on bowels of mercy and kindness and humbleness of mind and meekness and long suffering. And finally, if you put those things on, it'll lead to these actions. And there's really only, I thought it was interesting that he didn't list a lot of actions to be sought after in Christian living. He said, forbearance. Forbear. Forbear is loving patience. Practical Christianity shows out in the actions of being of forbearance. Aren't we supposed to forbear our brothers and sisters sometimes? I'm glad that they forbear me. We all know, those of us that have been married successfully for any length of time, that there's forbearance that has to happen. Both directions, right? Both directions, because we're both sinful people in a marriage. But the more that each spouse can forbear with the other, boy, that goes a long way to creating harmony, doesn't it? It's the same in our relationships among God's people. And if we can extend that to the outside and forbear on the outside, when we get an evil word or something from somebody out there in the world, when we can look and truly in our heart with humbleness of mind and say, "Well, I mean, what do I expect? That poor person is lost. They don't know the Lord. They're a child of the devil. Of course they're going to act out like that." Forbearing with them. That's what Paul says is an action. Forbearing, loving patience. Forgiveness. We know what forgiveness is. But forgiveness is restoration to favor. God talks about forgiveness. Jesus, he tells several parables about forgiveness, forgiveness, forgiveness. Why? Because has he not forgiven us? I've preached on forgiveness here. It's one of the hardest things for us to do is truly to forgive somebody. And you that have heard me preach know that I'm a firm believer that there cannot be forgiveness without repentance first. You can let it go, but you can't really forgive somebody that hasn't repented. God doesn't forgive anybody that hasn't repented, does he? We don't believe that. We believe to get saved, you have to repent. But when someone has repented, Peter said, if my brother offends me 70 times and apologizes, how many times apologizes the key comes and seeks, and Jesus says 70 times 7. But true repentance, and then true forgiveness. He said, we have to have a forgiving heart. And forgiveness is not holding it over their head. Right? God takes our sins and casts it as far as the east is from the west, doesn't he? He restores us to favor. That's what forgiveness on our part towards our fellow man is. It is restoring someone to favor. And finally, he says, let everything be done in charity.
charity. Now, you all know that that Greek word is agape, the highest form of love, godly love. But what's important is it's an active love. It's love with feet on it. That's why in the English it's translated charity. When we think of charity, we think of doing something for somebody or giving something to somebody. We don't just say, like James say, well, be warmed and filled. Be warmed and filled. James says that doesn't do anything. But true love is charity. We give them something to be warmed with. We give them something to be filled with. That's agape. That's true active love. And Paul says that's what we should put on. And so those old actions of malice and blasphemy and vile conversation and lying, put those off and instead put on forbearance and forgiveness and charity. That is practical Christianity. Finally, he goes into some roles, and these roles tie right into all that because so many of us, I know I spent a lot of years in my early ministry, and I still do from time to time, thinking, Lord, what do you want me to do? Lord, what do you want me to do? Where should I go? What should I do? Lord, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? And a lot of times I get silence on the other end, and that bothered me for a while. Until the Lord showed me, and I've probably mentioned this to you all before, that he reminded me, I guess, that now, when you were lost and needed to seek the Lord, wasn't I able to tell you were lost? Yeah, Lord, you told me I was lost. Said, and when you finally repented and were saved, wasn't I able to tell you were saved? And I said, yeah, Lord, you were able to tell me that. He said, now, when I wanted you to preach, didn't I make that clear? Yeah, you made that clear, Lord. When I led you to a church to pastor, when it was time, didn't I make that clear? Yeah, Lord, you made that clear. When it was time to leave a church, didn't I make that clear? Yeah, Lord, you made that clear. So why on earth do you think that you're going to miss a signal? See, a lot of times we think we're going to miss something from the Lord. Is the Lord telling me something I'm missing out on? No, when the Lord wants us to do something, He lets us know, doesn't He? He lets us know. And if He's not letting us know, then what He wants us to do is to abide in the things that we're supposed to do. 99%, probably more, of being a Christian is doing what God has already told us to do. It's not doing this one specific thing or this other specific thing. God can tell us, and He will, if He wants something specific. Most of the time, what He wants us to do is practical Christian living. And so, Paul says, here are some roles, here are some things in your everyday life that you need to do better at being Christians at. And he says, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands. I'm going to camp here, but we know why men and women are equal before God, but they don't have equal roles. And God has said, women, now submission is voluntary. He said, voluntarily submit yourselves to your husbands. Why? He tells us over in Ephesians, because it's a picture. Marriage is a picture. I've preached on this before. It's the voluntary submission of the wife to the husband. It's to picture our voluntary submission to Christ. Now, He deserves us our submission, but He doesn't force us, does He? He says, I want you to submit, but you have to voluntarily submit. Every day, don't we have to get up and voluntarily submit unto Christ? That's the picture. That's the picture. God has established roles. Do your role. Don't try to get into somebody else's role. Then He says, husbands, love your wives. Now, we don't understand today how radical this was in the culture that Paul lived in. Nobody talked about husbands loving their wives. That wasn't even a thing. They just had wives. Wives had duties, and husbands did whatever they wanted. That was just the reality of the world. Nobody was turning around. No philosophers. Nobody else was preaching, saying, now husbands, you need to love your wives and not be bitter towards them. Nobody was saying that. But God says that. Paul said that. He said, wives, yes, you've got a job. Submit to your husbands. But husbands, you've got a job, and that is to love your wives. And over in Ephesians, he tells us how? As Christ loved His church. And how was that? That was sacrificial love. That's big shoes to fill for a husband. But that's part of practical Christianity, is fulfilling those roles. Children, you have a role. What is it? To obey your parents. Why? Because your parents have an office that is ordained by God. And you need to respect that and obey them. He said, that's Christian living. That's Christian living. He said, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. He said, don't lord over them the power that you have. And provoking is also teaching. Don't teach them to be wrathful, but teach them. Don't teach them to get all that they can. Don't teach them the ways of the world, but teach them the ways of God. You have a role to do. Do it right. He said, servants. Now, he was talking about slaves and masters, but we don't have slaves, we don't have masters. But those of us that have jobs, everybody's got a job. Everybody's got a boss. Everybody's got somebody that they work for. So he said, work for them diligently, not with eye service as men pleasers, meaning not half-heartedly, only when somebody's looking, but diligently and truly do your very best to be the best worker that you can at whatever job that you're placed into. Whatever it is, do it to the best of your ability, knowing that you work, do all things for the glory of God. And so that covers most of our lives on most of a daily basis. And a few years ago, the Lord showed me, and I don't do very well at it at all. My wife will testify, and I don't do a very good job of it. But most of Christian living is learning how to be a better spouse, a better parent, a better child, a better worker, a better boss. Whatever those things are that you do in life, doing them better. Not better in the world's eyes, but better with bowels of mercy and kindness and humbleness of mind and meekness and long-suffering, with more forbearance and more forgiveness and more charity. That's practical Christianity, is living out those roles, whatever they are, by putting on the new man and putting off the old man. That's what Paul says. He says, it's not all of these other things. And so, to sum it up, it's not about seeking greater knowledge, like the Gnostics thought. Yeah, it's great to read your Bible. We need to, and I hope that I have a desire to know more about God, and I hope you do too. But that's not the essence of practical Christianity. It's not about taste not, touch not, avoid this, avoid that, all the rules, all the rituals. It's not about that. It's about putting off the old man, his character and his actions, putting on the new man with his characters and actions, and then fulfilling the roles that God has given us in our daily life with greater love, with greater forbearance, with greater forgiveness, being more merciful, being meeker, being kinder and more gentle in all of those things that we do. That's Christian living. That's what Paul is telling them in Colossians. You've been doing it wrong. You're seeking after the wrong things. This is where you need to focus. And I think if we as God's people could put the focus back where it needs to be more, then I believe that our relationships would flourish. Our relationships within the church, our relationships with people outside of the church would flourish. And our Christian witness would flourish more to the extent that we can do this more. I appreciate you listening. I hope that this will stick with you. The lessons of the Lord here on practical Christianity. What it really means to live as a Christian. Brother Dyer, if we can get a song.